Hey there, it's Ryan with Season 2 of 50 States of Mind. Before the episode starts, if you can take just a second and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts with something you learned from one of our episodes, it will help us continue with our mission of helping people start a dialogue here in America and overcome our preconceived notions about different parts of the country. Because we all know that one of the keys to bringing us all together is to talk a little less and listen a little more. Are you ready? Let's go. All right, this is 50 States of Mind. We are continuing with our string of remote recordings, and we have a very, very special guest joining us today. Thank you for being on the show, Juan. You're in Chicago right now, but yes. You moved here 6 years ago?
I moved here in the beginning of 2015.
And what did you do in Venezuela before you came to Chicago?
Well, I went to school for most of my life back there. High school and going to med school. Med school is straight right out of high school. It's not like here that you have to do undergrad and then med school. I did med school 7 years and then a year of internship. And then after that, I came to the US. That's pretty much the lowdown of my time in Venezuela. Just mostly studying.
And what made you decide to come to the US?
The social crisis in Venezuela unleashed due to the political crisis that had been ongoing for the past years. There is no future in Venezuela for anyone. If you are young, you want to build your life, build your professional career, and achieve lots of different things. And the country didn't provide the tools that anyone needs to achieve success, because it's a country that it's been destroyed, so there's basically no future back there for anyone. I needed to leave the country to be able to keep evolving as a human being, growth professionally and personally, and be able to shape my future.
And I think a lot of people aren't really aware of the logistics of the social and political crisis in Venezuela. Venezuela gets thrown out a lot in American politics, and we know that things aren't going well. Can you explain sort of what's going on down there?
Yeah, it's quite complicated. I'm going to try to make it as short and as simple as possible. The situation in Venezuela, is a crisis that was unleashed due to the socialist regime instated by Hugo Chavez, starting in 1999 when he was sworn into the presidency. Venezuela had been a country before that was very prosperous due to the oil production. Venezuela has one of the largest, if not the largest, oil reserves in the world. So back in the day, in the 70s and the 80s, there was a lot of money coming into the country and a lot of prosperity, a lot of growth. But the problem is that the growth wasn't equal. There was not equality in the country. So as a lot of people were growing and becoming more prosperous, some other people didn't see that. So there was a side of the population that resented the people that really did well. And this resentment kept growing as time went by, and the governments failed to control this disparity and failed to diminish the amount of people that didn't have access to a better quality of life. This unleashed into a lot of social protests. People were not happy with it. And that's when Chavez came and he tried to be the messiah, the savior of the poor people. He was a populist leader, and he, with his populist propaganda, he appealed to all of these people that were unhappy for a couple of decades. He won after he was in jail. He tried to overthrow the government in 2 occasions, and then he was given a presidential pardon. He ran for president, he won, and things started to just go down ever since. The thing that he advocated for was for social equality. So people were happy in the beginning because they thought that he was going to provide all the population with the quality of life that just some of them had for a while. But in reality, what they did was to create the ground for just the people in the government and the people that they knew that were connected to them, for them to become egregiously rich, and then the rest of the people just become poorer and poorer as time went by. It's a very complicated situation because it's something that's been ongoing for more than 20 years. It was gradual. Things just became worse and worse as time went by. People started to realize what they were doing in the country because they had a democratic facade, because of course he was elected by the people, he kept winning elections, but then people realized that they were rigging elections, then they realized that they were buying votes, then they realized that they were paying criminal and paramilitary organizations to keep people, threaten people to keep voting for them. I'm just touching the top of the iceberg. It's way more complicated. More recently, after Chavez died in 2013, he handpicked Nicolas Maduro, which is the leader right now, who won the election, a rigged election. He did it twice, and things just became even worse because there is no freedom of speech in the country at all. Chavez made sure that that was one of the first things that he did. He created a law where there was a lot of responsibility in radio, TV, newspapers, and in cinema. But this law was very broad. So it was basically something that they created so that the government could decide what was said and what couldn't be said in the media. So they have shut down TV stations, major TV stations. They have shut down radio stations. They have shut down newspapers. There's no freedom of speech, of course. Inflation right now is humongous. It's called hyperinflation right now. It's 1.3 million percent of inflation at the moment, which sounds ridiculous, but it's the truth. This is because they control the dollar income in the country. They have done that ever since 2002. You cannot go to a bank and get dollars to travel abroad, for example. If you live in any country where currency is free, you can just go to the bank and say, okay, I want to purchase $2,000 or $3,000 because I'm traveling abroad. No, you would have to go through a process where you ask for the government to give you a certain amount of dollars to be able to use them abroad. And then that was the way that they would control the international currencies coming into the country. Super corrupt way of handling the public arcs. And that's one of the main reasons why the inflation is what it is right now, that big. They also completely destroyed the private sector because they started expropriating factories, and they created this sense of insecurity for the private investors. Therefore, a lot of people pulled out their investments in Venezuela. A lot of companies either were expropriated by the government or they just shut down. And some other companies were nationalized, and their production just numbers just went to a historical low. And that's one of the reasons why there's no products in the country right now or anything, because everything that used to be produced in the country is not being produced anymore because the factory shut down. We don't have the raw materials because there's no dollars to import raw materials. And the few companies that produce things in the country that are nationalized produce just a small amount of things that are not able to provide for the amount of people that the country has. That's touching the basic aspects of the socioeconomic and political crisis.
Thank you for explaining it so well. And I have so many questions. I'll just ask three. The first question is your family safe? What is the day-to-day life for your family?
So my family is somewhat safe. They still live in my hometown, which is, what I told you, Western Venezuela. It's not close to Caracas. Caracas, which is the capital, is most dangerous cities in the world. If I'm not mistaken, it's the second most dangerous city in the Western Hemisphere. So they don't experience the high level of insecurity they experience there. They still have the struggles that regular Venezuelans have day-to-day to find regular day-to-day products that people need to be able to live, like food, medication, and hygiene supplies. So they have to manage if they can cross the border. If the border is open, they can cross the border and try to buy things in Colombia. Or if they find it in Venezuela, they have to pay super inflated prices to be able to get basic things such as toothpaste, deodorant, shampoo, soap, or toilet paper, which is one of the things that lack the most in the shelves in the stores in Venezuela. So they're just surviving like most of the regular people over there.
Well, my heart goes out to everyone in Venezuela right now. And my last question before we move on, does it ever get better? Is there hope for Venezuela to become a thriving country?
I would like to say yes, because I don't want to think that the people that I love back there will suffer for the rest of their lives, but it will take a very long amount of time and immense effort from an international coalition to be able to see an impactful change in Venezuela. Because when I'm telling you, when you are dealing with state, a government that is a criminal organization with branches that go to the Middle East with the Hezbollah, because they have connection with the Hezbollah, they have connection with paramilitary groups in South America, they run organized crime, bands and gangs inside the country, they run a drug cartel. It's not easy to overthrow a so-called government as dangerous and as powerful like as that, because of course it's not just about overthrowing two or three top officials or leaders. This is about completely bringing down the network of crime, and it's not easy. So for Venezuela to see a real change, they would have to bring down the complete network of crime, and that to me sounds almost impossible.
Okay, well, there's something else I want to touch on, but I think in one of the recordings we're going to get to it, and that's the idea of Venezuela being an example of socialism, but we'll get there. My question for you has to do with things right here at home, and that is, what do you know, Juan, about the state of Virginia?
I don't know much, to be honest. I've been in the U.S. just for five years, and I don't know much about Virginia. I know overall about the dynamics of the country, but not about specific states, besides Illinois, of course.
There's a lot of dynamics there. Well, don't feel bad, because a lot of people who have lived here for, 60 years don't know a lot of the dynamics of the individual states. So Virginia is a state that I'm actually going to kind of lump in with the capital city, D.C., because Virginia borders it. And a lot of people live in Virginia and commute to D.C. And most of my time spent in Virginia, unfortunately, was spent at wineries. So I didn't get a lot of really good information out of the wineries because I was, drinking wine. But I have a few interesting recordings that I think might be cool to talk about. And the first one is with a big catch, a real life presidential candidate. This is probably not a presidential candidate you've heard of before, because her name is Melody Crombie, and she ran for president in 2016 as an evangelist. She is trying to bring Christian values back to America. I met her while I was in D.C. right outside the White House, where she was, talking to anyone who had talked to her about her vision for the country. So I want to play you my interview with Melody, and then we can chat about it.
Yeah, I'm Melody Crombie. I come down here. I'm an evangelist and a former presidential candidate considering running again. I come down here and just try to talk about Jesus, how people can get saved. I have pretty much a fixed speech that I try to put on my website, melodycrombie.com. And it's under current campaign, and I've been doing this for since before the last election, so since 2015.
Okay. What inspired you to run in the, was this your first time running in 2016?
It was, yes.
What inspired you to run?
Just the decision of the Supreme Court to go ahead and approve gay marriage in our country. I just thought that was something that was so grievous to the heart of God that I, you know, just really meant that people had to stand up. I felt like they just take a stand. Historically, this has been bad.
How do you feel about the Supreme Court making a decision versus the states passing a law and legalizing it? Do you feel like there's a difference?
I think maybe the Supreme Court tries to talk for the whole, you know, I know that probably other states have legalized, but I think the Supreme Court maybe opened a doorway that wouldn't have been opened previously. So, yeah.
And then are there other issues? If you could rank your top three issues in your platform, what would they be?
Bringing morality back to our nation, bringing, you know, godliness, Bible teaching back to our schools, that kind of thing. Just really trying to get the country back on the right track, you know, because we've always been a Christian, godly nation, and that's where we've had our strength. And I think when we turn away from that, we're just going to see so much destruction. You know, God's going to turn away from us, basically. So.
Right. And what do you think about the current administration?
I am a Republican. I'm for Trump. I think he was so much better than Hillary. I just can't, you know, can't believe anybody would have voted for her. We'll see. She might come around again.
So would you, if you were to run in a party, are you running independently and in your own party?
I would run as a Republican.
As a Republican. Yeah. Would you challenge Trump?
You know, if I decided to run again and he was running again, which I assume he will be running in 2020, I guess I would be, but I'm not any kind of a, you know, known person like he is. So.
Right. If you were president, your first 100 days, what would you try to get done?
You know, I would definitely try to just bring, you know, the whole separation of church and state was not in the Constitution. I would just try to bring people back to just reading the Bible, going, you know, that kind of thing.
So is there a piece of legislation you would pass? Would you make it mandatory for Bible to be taught in schools? I went to Catholic high school, so I had religion classes every day. Would you want something like that?
Hi, guys. You know, I don't know if... I mean, there's been so much that's come out of the Catholic Church. I don't know if... I feel like you saying that is probably, oh my goodness, probably some abuse victim or something, but because there's so, been so much. You know.
Oh, I'm not an abuse victim.
You're not.
Okay. I'm not even Catholic. I'm Protestant. So.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. No, I don't think all Catholics are abuse victims, but I'm sure there are some. Would that be a policy you'd be interested in? Like every public school has. A Bible class or
yes.
A religion class?
Yeah, that would be.
But in a particular sect of Christianity, or would it be like Protestant or?
Mostly Protestant, yeah.
Because our country was mostly based on Protestant values,
yeah.
Right? Okay, that's amazing. Where are you from originally?
California.
Really?
Yeah.
What part?
kind of the middle part, you know. California is such a huge state. When I mention California, a lot of people are always, you know, oh yeah, I lived in San Diego. Well, that, yeah, not
yeah,
me.
It's not. It's roughly half the size of the country, basically. It's the entire West Coast. Okay, anything else you want to say to people, potential voters, about your platform, what you believe in?
No, I just pretty much say it all here on the street, and so.
And have you gotten good feedback from people? Do people come listen?
It really depends. I don't, you know, because it's the street, and there are people that want to come and wipe me out, and thank God for the Secret Service who are around, because.
And they're nice to you and protect you. And,
they're very nice, yes. They're very kind. They're, you know, always here, so. I used to come with my kids because I was just so uncertain about coming by myself, but, you know, they're around. They're not always listening, but, you know.
Right.
That's okay. You know?
One more question about political civility in this country. Do you feel like you could, if you were president, work with people that you had disagreements on fundamental issues with? Could you work with Democrats?
I hope so. I mean, because we are trying to be, you know, one nation under God kind of thing. You know, the Democrat Party today isn't the one that, you know, was back in what they said, you know, before Grandfather's Day, you know, when there was a certain group of people that, you know, went to church, tried to do the right thing and all that, you know, by bringing socialism in and that kind of thing. I mean, that's just a doorway to communism. And we've seen Venezuela, you know, fighting for food and everything. It's just, it's bad. So.
Do you think you could work with people in the Democratic Party if they were, if they, you knew they all had Christian values? Do you think that would be sort of a unifying thing for the government? If
possibly.
Yeah. Could you work with someone who wasn't a Christian or find common ground?
Possibly. You know, it just depends. I mean, I'm married to a Democrat.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yeah.
How does that work? Was he a Hillary fan?
No. He just felt like the party abandoned, you know, their values and stuff. So, you know, he's been a non-Christian for most part of his life. So, you know, it's just...
Really?
Yeah.
How does...
But he's very decent. He's very hardworking. He's very, you know, so...
Is it difficult to maintain a marriage with someone that you don't have that shared language with? You don't believe the same things?
Yes. But it's given me a lot of good arguments for, you know, like he believes Darwinian evolution and stuff like that. And I don't, because I just see it as so archaic and so Victorian, you know, and so
right.
old. It's stupid, really. I hate to say that.
Do you think it's better to be married to someone that you don't agree with on everything? Does that make you... It's not?
No. Bible says, do not be unequally yoked. And I think Satan tries every trick in the book to get Christians to marry people who aren't Christians. And I fell for it. And that's probably, you know, been kind of the Achilles heel of our marriage. But, you know, by the grace of God, we've just been able to get it, you know, make it work. So.
And you would never get a divorce because...
My parents divorced, and that was really horrible. And I've got seven kids. So,
seven kids. Oh, yeah. So it's your kind. Are you? I mean, there's obviously love in your marriage, but you're.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really tough. Okay, Juan, Melody, not your typical presidential candidate. She's got big dreams. Got a lot of spunk. What do you think of what Melody had to say?
I think she has the dreams of an average American for a more unified country than we have right now for everyone. And I think that's valid. I don't agree in the way that she wants to do some of the things because I don't think that bringing religion into the equation is going to change things. Because when you're talking about morals and values, I don't think religion and morals and values are sine qua non conditions at all.
Totally agree. And I don't want to make it seem like I am putting her on here to like make fun of her because it does seem like a little nutty. But the more you kind of listen to what she's saying, you realize that she actually thinks that what she's doing is right. The fact that the gay marriage decision Supreme Court was what made her run for president. And I asked her and I said, So what are you going to do about it? And she didn't really say, I was like, are you going to put, you know, Bible class in school? I think one of the things that was so fascinating about it is finding out that she's in this marriage where she's married to someone who isn't even Christian, but she can't divorce him because
she cannot divorce someone because they cannot believe in divorce.
Yeah. So I'm like, is this about you? Are you doing this because of something going on in your life right now? And, you know, she clearly isn't a crazy person. She just believes very strongly and is shooting for something that's kind of impossible. But I don't know. Do you think she thinks she's doing the right thing?
Of course she thinks she's doing the right thing. I don't think it's the right thing because trying to overthrow a decision that was already made by the Supreme Court in regards of social equality, I think that's just a huge setback for the country.
You know, maybe get your own marriage sorted out before you start telling other people what to do. It sounds...
maybe, yes. maybe don't get married to someone that's not even in your same religion.
That was her advice to me. You know, make sure you marry someone the same religion as you. I was like, all right, well, you're not going to like it. But one thing that I wanted to ask you is she quickly name checked Venezuela. I'm not sure you heard that in there. So I guess my question for you, it's kind of a two-part question. The first part is, did Venezuela fail as a state because of the socialist aspect, or was it because it was a socialist facade run by a criminal organization? And then the second question is, do you think Venezuelan socialism is the same thing as Norwegian socialism?
I'm going to answer part by part. First of all, I think that the state completely failed because of the so-called socialist policies. But the fault is not 100% of the Chavista regime, because the social democrats were in power for 40 years. There was a bipartisan shifting between two parties, both leftists doing whatever they want to do in the country, and they paved the way with the social democrat policies for someone like Chavez to take over and completely run the show in a socialist regime and destroy the country. So that's the first part. The second part, of course, the fact that the government is also a criminal institution involving different types of crimes makes it even more difficult, because they are not advocating for the Venezuelans. They're just advocating for themselves. They're using the status of being the head of a country to conduct their criminal practices and make a profit for themselves while the people are dying and starving in the streets. And the difference between the Norwegian socialism and Venezuelan socialism lies in the fact that there is no way to compare a country like Venezuela and a country like Norway. It is way different. You have to compare the amount of people that are in every country, the levels of corruption in every country, and the actual way that they conduct socialism in the country. Because while in Venezuela they instated a full socialist regime, in Norwegia what they used were socialist aspects that they added into the state to make things work in a more efficient way and in a way that would benefit their citizens more. That's what they did over there. So I think the comparison is very difficult to make, because you have to put two nations that would be very similar to be able to compare.
Yeah.
And there is no way to compare a third world country with a first world country and all the characteristics of each one.
So I'm puzzling here, because on the last episode of the podcast, I had Alex, who is married to a Norwegian, has spent a lot of time in Norway, and talks about how the Norwegian culture and socialist aspects of the government lead to more equality. So I guess my question for you is, are you okay with aspects of socialism? And is it the American politicians glorifying socialism in countries but not acknowledging the fact that it's devastating lives in places like Venezuela?
Yes, I think there are aspects of socialism that can work. But the problem is that they are being misused here by a populist candidate guaranteeing free this, free that. There's nothing for free. People fail to think that they get everything for free in those countries, in those Scandinavian countries. They pay almost 50% of all their income in taxes, which is a lot. That's one of the reasons why they are able to fund socialized medicine and affordable education. Because it's not free education. People still have to pay tuition fees and monthly tuition fees or quarterly tuition fees according to the schools that they go to, but it's affordable. So I do think that socialist aspects would improve the quality of the American individual, but nothing's for free. So I think that's the first mistake of the socialist leaders. They have to stop advocating for free things, instead advocate for affordable things in this country. So that's also something that people have to think, that electing a president wouldn't change things that much. Because in the bipartisanship right now here, the leaders that have been elected from either or party, I somewhat safe political ideologies that don't go to the extreme of being fascist or being communist. I mean, we have Cuba that is 11 kilometers away from the Florida coast. People in Florida know of these things, but some of them don't. Some of them want a revolution. And I just want you to take a look at all the Venezuelans and the Cubans that have had to flee their country because of the crisis that has been caused by the revolution that you want to be, that you have, want to happen in this
world.
I had someone trying to tell me about Venezuela, and I'm like, how long have you lived there? No. How long have you lived there? Or have you ever been there? No. What do you know about it? No, you have no idea what you're talking about. And when you're talking about something that you don't know, you are, the likelihood of you being wrong is, the chances are very high.
Yeah, there's nothing more infuriating when someone tries to explain your own experience to you. I think that idea of privilege is super astute. And I'm sure sharing these opinions can be unpopular, because a lot of people feel like if you don't support their point of view, then you're working against progress. But I think your point of view is more important than ever. I actually think this kind of perfectly segues into the last interview, which is with a federal employee. Her name is Mary Kendall. She's the Inspector General of the Department of the Interior. So basically, her job is to put a check on a federal department to make sure everything's running smoothly. And I talked to her a little bit about what the transition between different administrations looks like, how it changes the culture, and how basically our federal government does work, even when it's not working the way that you as a person agree with. So let's listen there.
I'm Mary Kendall. Do you need my title, Deputy Inspector General, Department of Interior?
It doesn't hurt, does it?
No, it's not.
Do you feel like the culture of DC has changed in the past few years?
The culture in DC changes. This has been, I don't know how many administrations, I'd have to think a little harder, but I started in the Reagan administration, toward the, I guess, the middle of the Reagan administration, working in federal government, and the feel does change with every administration. The other thing, though, that I think has changed considerably over the 32 years I've been here is the extreme partisanship that is exhibited both on Capitol Hill and in the administration. When I first started, of course, I didn't have the view that I have now, but it just seemed like the Congress worked better with itself, it worked better with the administration, and the administrations seemed, they all had their policies and, you know, their goals, whatever it was that they intended to do, what their promises were during campaigns or elections, but they seemed more willing to work with the opposing party, people that they needed to get to where they needed to go, and that has, for the most part, at least in my perception, just sort of fallen by the wayside. Things have become so partisan, and in the administration as well, but very much so on Capitol Hill. One of the things that my office does, because we're supposed to be nonpartisan, is we often, if we have to brief staff, we'll say we would like to have both majority and minority there. Sometimes they'll concede, sometimes they won't. And if, let's say, the majority asks us to brief them on something, we say, would you invite the minority? They say yes, we brief both sides. And if they say no, we just let them know that we'll talk to them, but then we're going to go to the minority and talk to them as well and let them know what we told the majority. And it's just the one way that we can stay nonpartisan, which is one of our statutory mandates.
Do you have a pretty good sense of who is aligned with what party in your department?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Certainly when the politicals come in with an administration, you know where they're aligned. But the career folks tend to be pretty circumspect. There are some that are in particular arenas, like, say, climate change, where they made it very clear when the administration changed that they were not in keeping with the administration, and frankly, the administration made it pretty clear that they weren't in keeping with these folks. So you would see that from time to time, but I'd say, excuse me, most of the professional career folks view civil service as serving for a long time and serving the administration that is in power at the time. You kind of have to bite your political tongue or your personal views. And my feeling is that as long as what they're doing is legal, they have the right to change policies, whether I agree with them or not personally. There's probably 3 or 4 people in the department, actually not even in the department, in my organization who have any inclination of what my political leaning is, because I mask it as well as I possibly can all the time. So it's a little bit of a dance.
Mm-hmm. And when they talk about the deep state, based on what you've seen, is that something that could exist or is possible to exist, or would it be just so clear that that is something going on?
I think it's a myth. I think it's something that somebody wants people to believe. I've seen no evidence of it myself, but I kind of don't spend a lot of time looking at it or thinking about it.
Okay, so that was Mary Kendall, no longer with the Department of the Interior, but the time I visited, she was. Did anything Mary said strike any inspiration in you?
So I think the topic of bipartisanship, I do believe people have become more radical in recent years. And I think the accelerator or the catalyst for this is having a leader. He has said a lot of unsavory things about a lot of people, Americans and North Americans, and that has given a lot of people the false thought that they can pretty much say whatever they want to say and think whatever they want to think without any consequence. And that has made people on both sides become more extreme in their beliefs, in their wishes and desires. So, and that's something that she said, that she's seen the change in people on both sides during these governments. And I do agree that people have just become more radical in the recent years.
I think the only way to combat that is to actually talk to people, realize other people have other opinions that are based on their experiences and facts, and realize that if someone disagrees with you, it doesn't mean they're necessarily wrong. But if you're just going to keep yelling at each other, you're never going to get anything done, and things are just going to get a lot worse. But I think the big takeaway comes from what you just said. Like, don't talk about something you don't know about. I think that's a huge problem. Don't regurgitate something that someone else said to you. Like, if you want to do your own research, have an opinion on that, take ownership of it, great. But there are a lot of people arguing at each other when they have no idea what they're talking about.
That's dangerous, because that's some sort of the snowball effect. You just increment in the size of something just because of what you hear, not because of your knowledge. And that's dangerous. Calm the waters and try to make things done instead of just...
Yeah, and I really do think that the idea of like being a centrist,
I think people misunderstand because there are two kinds. There are people that take like little bits from both sides and make like small changes. But I think there's the idea of listening to all perspectives, hearing what people have to say, hearing people's concerns, and trying to find something that addresses all of those concerns, not just listening to your side. I think of it less of just taking the center and just trying to be all encompassing and understand why people feel the way they do and trying to be sensitive. And I think that really goes back to, you know, don't just talk about something because you read it on the news. We need to be really vigilant about making sure our opinions are our own and that we can really take ownership of them and that we can be humble enough to listen to other people who have different opinions and maybe even, you know, realize that we weren't as smart as we thought we were.
Absolutely. I had so much fun talking about this. This is a great time during a quarantine.
Well, yeah.
I feel my neurons moving again.
That's what I'm here for. I'm an educational program, really. I'm here to keep everyone's minds churning during this maddening time. Thanks for listening. If you have the time, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. And if you want to engage with us on social media, we are 50 States of Mind on Facebook and Instagram and 50 States Pod on Twitter. Special thanks to Bright Moments for the theme music and our entire team for putting in so much hard work. See you next time.